Visions. I'm your host, Ann Harper. Tonight, we're sitting down with New York Times best-selling author Kelly Corrigan to talk about her latest book, Tell Me More, Stories About the 12 Hardest Things I'm Learning to Say. This is Kelly's fourth book. She's also written The Middle Place, Lift, Glitter, and Glue. She's also the creative director of the Nantucket Project and host of their conversation series about what matters most. She's been called the voice of her generation and the poet laureate of the ordinary. She lives right here in the Bay Area in East Bay. Welcome, Kelly Corrigan. So thrilled to have you on City Visions.
Thanks, Anne.
And we will invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation in about 25 minutes by dialing our toll-free line, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website or follow us on Twitter at #cityvisionskalw. So, Kelly, before we get into your most recent book, Tell Me More, I'd actually like to start with your first memoir, The Middle Place.
Sure. At the
time, I found myself recommending The Middle Place to when it came out to friends, and I would say something like, you know, it's amazing. It's a memoir about this mother of young children who discovers she has breast cancer, and just a few months later, while she's undergoing treatment, her father, who she adores, gets bladder cancer, and it's so funny. And they look at me like I was insane, but it is a very funny book, which is surprising given the subject matter. I mean, and this is kind of a consistent theme throughout your books. You find the humor in really dark places, and you hold the serious and the funny at the same time. What's that like, both in life and in writing?
Yeah.
Is it tricky?
Well, it's funny to hear you say that about The Middle Place, because when I first shared it with the woman who became my agent, she said that the trick with getting a publisher to pick this up and put it out there is that it could get set aside as, quote-unquote, a cancer memoir, and they just don't do well, typically.
Right.
And she said, only the people who read it will know that it's really about the difference between being someone's kid when you're a kid and being their kid when you're all grown up. And her impression of it, and the reason she liked it, is because it was like a love letter to my dad.
Right.
And so it does cover this one year where we're both fighting cancer, but it also, every other chapter is a flashback to childhood. And she then, when the publisher bought it, they said, our biggest fear is that people are going to stand at the bus stop and say to each other, what are you reading? And they're going to say, I'm reading this book about a woman who had breast cancer, and then her dad got cancer, and then everyone's going to be like, great, moving on. And so, right. Yeah, it is... I mean, there are funny people in my life. I guess that's why The Middle Place is funny, is my mom is a really, like, $1 million character. You couldn't write her. And my father is his own distinct character from her.
Yeah.
And then I have these two older brothers. And they are, in real life, very amusing, broadly drawn people. And
right.
So it wasn't terribly difficult to keep a sense of humor about everything, mm-hmm. because that was the truth of that year. Is that we went through things the way we always go through things, which is, you know, a quick hug and then you look funny bald, you know?
How like, do they feel about you writing about them?
You know, it's interesting, but very positive generally, to cut to the chase. But it is interesting at a very specific level what a given person who I'm writing about or touching on in a story, what they might object to. And I've discovered over 4 books in 10 years that it's very difficult to predict what will be a problem for someone. Hmm. So, like, I wrote a line about my older brother that I thought was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And he totally caught me off guard by saying, you can't say that about me. Like, everybody I know is going to read this book. And I was like, I thought that was kind of a cool thing about you.
Right.
And he was like, yeah, I don't want that in there. And then, so then I told my other brother, like, GT didn't want me to do that. And Booker said, I'll give that quote to me. I love it. Like, more ink, the better. So, you know, it's a funny thing. And my mother said with The Middle Place, so pretty early on in The Middle Place, I mentioned casually that I was suspended from high school for a week for being drunk at the sophomore semi-formal.
Right.
And I witnessed, the reason I wanted to tell the story is because I witnessed this difference in my parents, which was that my mother took it so to heart, like took my safety and security and development as if it were like a life and death.
Right.
Which, as it is at some level. And my dad was kind of a jolly optimist. It was like, come on, Mary. Like, she's a great kid. She's pointed in the right direction. Like, it's going to be a little bit of a bumpy ride with her, but she's going to get out there. And just hearing them argue that out and seeing the different, their two strikingly different perceptions of me and where I was relative to where they were hoping I was going. Mm-hmm. And like, the level of risk with me as a kid. Like, was I totally fine but just screwed up? Or was this, like, the beginning of some divergence from the path I was meant to walk? And so that's why I wanted to share it. But so then my mom read the book, and I said, Mom, what'd you think? And she said, wow, Kelly, it's beautiful. And I was like, God, Mom, like, you may have just cured our entire relationship in three words. And she said, however, I don't think we need to tell the whole world that you got drunk as a sophomore in high school. And I said, oh, Ma, like, nobody cares about that. I'm like a 40-year-old woman. And she said, well, I care about it. And you said I could change anything I wanted to. And I said, no, no, no. What I said was that if there's anything about you in there that you want me to take out, I'll take it out. Right. And she said, that story is about me. That was on my watch.
Oh.
And I, at the time, thought it was hilarious that that was her take on it, that that would reflect poorly mm-hmm. on her. And now that I have a rising sophomore and a rising senior, I can appreciate that it is, sometimes we take things as a failure that on us, the parent, that we really shouldn't.
Right.
But nonetheless, we feel that sense of like, God, nobody else's kid got suspended.
Even if it is 30 years later or
even
however
if it
long.
Is, even if it is.
Right. So the middle place really does seem like a tribute to your dad, Greeny. Can you tell us more about him and what he was like and what your relationship was like with him?
It was heaven. It was the easiest relationship I've ever had. I just felt like we were made for each other. Like, we were just such a natural relationship. And what I think about him as I reflect on his parenting is he was unconsciously fabulous. Like, he loved me. He loved listening to me. He loved hearing about my day. He loved my company. Like, he wanted me to go to the dry cleaners with him because it would be more fun if I was there. And he wanted me to go with him to his dentist appointments because he said he would get better treatment if they saw that I was with him. And, you know, when I went, and I used to ride the train with him every now and then to New York. He worked in New York, and we grew up in Philly. And I would go up to the city with him for the day and hang around and, like, make copies on the Xerox machine and, you know, bother people at the office and then go for a fancy lunch. And when I would go on the Amtrak, all these people that he commuted with for 10 years would say, oh, my God, George, is this the Kelly Corrigan? You know, like, it just... And he, it wasn't just me. I mean, that's how he loved GT. That's how he loved Booker. That's how he loved my mom. Like, he's just so effusive and very, like, insanely low needs. Like, he had no ego needs himself. Like, he just did his job. I mean, he wasn't, like, he was really competitive. So he was a great athlete. So he sold ad space and Good Housekeeping, and he wanted to be the best-selling salesperson, and he was. But he wasn't, he didn't have needs to me, it didn't seem. All he needed was like a dog. Like, he needed to run every day and sweat every day and take many showers. Like, he's a big fan of like the shower shave at 6 o'clock at night after the tennis game. And
nice.
So he's really joyful and really energetic and just that I loved him so much. I like, if he were my age, he would have been my best friend.
Did he do the heavy stuff, too? There's a scene that you describe in The Middle Place where you've just discovered this lump in your breast that it's cancerous, and you announce this to your closest friends via email by inviting them to a party a year from then where they'll be dancing and hugging and celebrating. But in the meantime, because you have breast cancer, you'll be dealing with chemo, surgery, and radiation. And you end the chapter saying something like, I'm no George Corrigan, but I can do a pretty good imitation when I need to. Obviously, handling a super serious situation in a light way. What was he like in the more serious moments when you're dealing with serious things, like you both were?
You know, in a crisis, you would really want my mom. To be honest, she's very tactical, and she's very devoted. So she would, you know, when I called her, she went to work. She found a second opinion. She found somebody who knew somebody who could get me in touch with the people at Sloan Kettering. Mm-hmm. She had me on the phone with a guy named Larry Norton, who is to this day like the breast cancer expert in the United States. You know, she had looked things up. She had questions that I should ask. She wanted to know exactly when I should come out. Did I want her and my dad at the same time, or should they space it out? What would be better for the kids? Like, she's mm-hmm. very...
Boots on the ground.
Yeah, she wants to make a list, and she wants to check it off twice. Mm-hmm. And, like, she was incredible planning our wedding. You know, like, that's mm-hmm. the binder. And then my dad would just hug me. Mm-hmm. And he was such a, like, when he came out, so I did 8 chemos, and I had somebody came every time, because I live in California, but a lot of my closest pals are still on the East Coast. And so people were coming out, and it became like this, like, rotating party almost. Like, I tolerated chemo much better than I expected to, and it wasn't until, like, chemo 6, 7, and 8 when I really started to feel awful, mm-hmm. and where I had really excruciating bone pain, which is from the Neupogen, which is something you have to do to keep your white blood cell count up so that you can keep your schedule, because I did my chemo extra fast because I was young and I had an aggressive cancer. Wow. So it's called dose dense, where you do it at this kind of clipped pace. And but when my dad came, we would just play the guitar. We'd have his friend Ben Swan over. We'd play the piano. Like, we just turned it into this... Like, nobody was there, and I just had my little bald head out, and the kids were in their diapers and, you know, in their baggy bottom pajamas, and it was like a free-for-all. You know, we didn't cook dinner. We just, like, made the plate of salami and cheese, and that's what we ate for dinner, and we drank too much, and it was all kind of fabulous. And then my mom came. We did laundry, and we got the car washed, you know, and she had her list. And that's, like, a thing to learn as an adult, and it's a way that we can come to accept each other. And it just happened when my dad died that in these big moments, like, people are going to do it the way they need to do it. And for my mom, she needed to make the list, and it would have killed her to hug me. She would not want to do that. It would make her start to cry, and that would make her feel like she wasn't serving me the way she wanted to. And she's a soldier, you know. And my dad just wanted to sit next to me on the couch. You know, he wouldn't have dreamed of getting up to go do the laundry, because it was like he wouldn't want to leave me. And when my dad was dying, my mom was doing it her way, and I was doing it my way. And we were driving. It took about 2.5 weeks or something that I was back in Philadelphia as it was unfolding. And, you know, there were 4 of us, my 2 brothers, me, and my mom, and we're kind of rotating in and out of the lead slot or whatever. And my mom had a harder time just being in the room with him, you know, and it's different. Her husband's dying and my father's dying, and it's just a different thing. And then I'm different and she's different. And so anyway, we were driving one day and she said, you're very good at this. And I said, oh, thanks. And she said, now listen, we're both going to do this our own way. Let's not judge each other. And I thought, like, no chance. Absolutely no chance. I promise I will not judge you. And you didn't even need to say that. I was already there. Like, and that's a thing to learn, is that it doesn't, the way you would love a person looks like this. It's, and that doesn't mean that somebody who loves you that doesn't look like that, that it isn't every bit as devoted and thorough and committed.
That's really insightful of her to point that out. Talk a little bit more about your relationship with your mother. You wrote Glitter and Glue, also a memoir, much of which takes place in Australia, where you're a nanny for a family that has recently lost their mother. And the book, of course, is about your own mother. Can you tell us first about the title, Glitter and Glue?
Yeah. And, so my mom famously, regularly used to remind us that your father's the glitter, but I'm the glue. It takes both, Kelly. And... you know, that's a concept that's almost impossible to understand until you're in a marriage yourself or in a partnership. And it can even be a work partnership where you feel like, oh, I get it. You're the front man. And I'm like, you know, we at Children's Hospital, for all the volunteering we do, we say to our team there, like, we'll catch them, you clean them. Like, we're going to go out there in the world and we're going to find great potential donors, and then we're going to pass them to you, and you're going to, like, get it all done the way they want it done, and, you know. And so in some ways they were an amazing pairing. And both partners, both players valued the other equally. Like, it was an incredible experience for my mom to be married to somebody that extroverted and that at home in the world and that optimistic. And it was an incredible experience for my father to be married to someone who was that loyal, that low maintenance, and that grounded.
Yeah. So with your own children, are you more glitter or more glitter?
You know, I'm kind of glittery, and I mean, I'm very outgoing, and I'm like 100% extroverted. But so I like their friends, and I like to socialize with them, and you know, that kind of thing. I love throwing parties the whole time. I mean, now I can't throw parties because they're teenagers and there's too much sneaking around. But going through eighth grade, we were a house that had a lot of parties, and but I am way more of a disciplinarian than Edward is.
Oh.
Like, I really think there are rules. So we're now doing curfew stuff, mm-hmm. where I think the curfew, she's a rising senior, I think it should be 11. He thinks it should be 12. He actually doesn't even think there needs to be a curfew. He's like, she's totally proven to be trustworthy, and I think it's kind of silly. And then I'm like, okay, great, hand me the phone. You're out. Like, you're not allowed to participate in this conversation any longer.
Right. So your most recent book, Tell Me More, is a collection of stories about things you're learning to say. And in it, you talk about two significant losses, the loss of your father, Greeny, and the loss of your friend, Liz, who died after a very long struggle with cancer. It seemed to me like you knew exactly what to say at important moments. Did it feel like that at the time, or did you find yourself struggling to know how to put into words what you were feeling at the time?
I felt I never had any struggle finding words with Greeny. So there was nothing important to be said at the end. I just kept saying the same old stuff I'd always said. I love you, I love you, I love you. The story I tell in the book is called Tell Me More, which it got the title because what's very difficult to do if you're proactive and you have a certain sense of how you want to love people, your kids and your spouse and your parents and your brothers. My idea of that was to lean in and to be vocal and to come up with ideas and solutions and brainstorm with them about next steps. And that is often not as curative as I would have thought. It's often actually condescending and arrogant because it sort of suggests that the solution is so easy, and why can't you just see it and just do what I'm telling you to do and everything will be fine? And that's not actually a very compassionate or honest point of view. And so it's a little disrespectful of the problem itself. And so saying tell me more is to lean back and to create space and to be a witness. And that I really believe in. I mean, I really believe in it with teenagers. I really believe in it with Edward. Like, you know, my husband has a job that I am not capable of understanding. He does AI software, this thing called Machinify. And I don't know what it is. I don't know how it works. And sometimes I still have an opinion about it, which is just like beyond absurd. And sometimes when I catch myself saying, well, why don't you say it a persona, like blah, 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 he says, he just kind of looks at me like, huh, good, thank you. Super helpful, Kelly. Like Kelly who didn't take math in college. And I think, right, this is almost this crazy for me to be like telling my kids what to do. And it's almost this much like shutting somebody down to come like powering back with all these suggestions. And so with my dad, when he was dying, and you know, and I clearly have him on a pedestal, but I also believe that my impression of him and my reporting on him such that it is in these books is 100% accurate. And anyone who knows him would back me up on that, including my brothers and my mom. Like, he really was that great. He was just an extraordinary human being who I happen to get to be the kid of. And when he was dying, he had this anxiety and this regret. And I was so thrown by it that I almost didn't want to hear it, because it felt super threatening to me, to this idea I had of him. Like, it didn't seem possible to me that there was something deep that he could be regretting. And then I thought, oh my God, he's going to tell me something like, we're in debt, or he cheated on my mom, or he stole something from a work, you know, he embezzled. Or so I said, I had to really force myself to say, tell me whatever you want to tell me. And the thing he regretted was that he didn't name one of his kids after his old lacrosse coach who put him through college. And the reason he was so grateful to his lacrosse coach putting him through college was that my mom never would have married like a bucktooth dropout. So it was like everything good in his life, he leads him back to my mom. And he's in his analysis, like, we're all doing like our little analysis, like, these are the pivotal moments of my life that led me to the thing that makes everything else possible. In his analysis, the only way he could have gotten her was with a good degree and a good job. And he said, and this coach was just so instrumental to me. And
so you may not have ever known that had you not been willing to sit with him and say, tell me.
Right, right. And also, I really do believe that like 80-90% of the time when we're quickly perceiving the problem, we're wrong. And you wouldn't know it because you're talking too much. And if you just keep saying, tell me more, tell me what else, go on, like, then there's the thing, and then there's the thing behind the thing, and the thing behind the thing behind the thing, and that's really the problem. And it happens with my daughters all the time, where they'll present something, and I could treat the presenting symptom, or I could keep asking questions, and then by the time they get to all the way to the bottom of it, it's something I never would have understood. I never could have seen that far in. And then once they get there, then they start working their way out. And I'm just like a witness to this sort of miraculous thing, especially when you're raising kids. Like, it's a really incredible thing to see a kid solve their own problem.
Right.
It's like thrilling.
Right.
But you can't do it if either you solve the problem or they solve the problem. And you're probably going to get it wrong. And also you're depriving them of this incredible achievement.
Right. Speaking of talking, I want to do a little bit more in case people are just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're talking to Kelly Corrigan. Her most recent book is Tell Me More, which is about the hardest but most important things people can say to one another. If you have a question or comment for Kelly, please call us. Or if there are phrases that have helped you connect to people during difficult times, call in or email us. The number to call to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. Which is 866-798-8255, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on our website, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So if you wouldn't mind, Kelly, I would love for you to read a little section from your book on saying I love you from Tell Me More.
Sure. So there's a lot of unusual things that I think we have to say to each other, like good enough and I was wrong. But the most obvious thing that people say that is required of adults in long-term permanent relationships is that we actually have to say I love you to each other. And it's like sort of a trite thing to put in a book. And then I had to stew on it for a long time until I found what I really think that means. And so that's what this is about. I remember kind of swooning when I learned how the French say it, je t'adore. I was in high school, and the phrase brought to mind kitten heels, martinis, and open mouth kissing. But really, when you're grown up, I love you is more romantic than the perfumey je t'adore. Informed love, love that is cut across time and thwarted its pressures, is a two-tone emotion, and the plain, full statement of it often makes my throat clog with feeling. I love you is not I love your giggle and mysterious expressions or the way your bra matches your panties. It's even though your neck dropped into a waddle last year and you burp a lot after you eat Thai food and have not conquered your social insecurities, and I heard you yell sharply at our kids again, and you still can't seem to bring yourself to be nicer to my mom or ask for that raise, I love you. As for the rest of our permanent relationships, where people know each other too well, I find it nearly incomprehensible that in spite of every offense and oversight, we can still say I love you and mean it. I believe this emotional largesse is sometimes called forgiveness. Immediate, often unsolicited, sometimes undeserved forgiveness. That is what turns the wheel of family life. We forgive our parents for being wrong about us in so many ways, for seeing some things and not others, for missing the point. Our siblings for being smarter or richer, more athletic or happier than we are. Our children for diverging from our expectations, for scaring us with their developmentally appropriate but still dreadful risk-taking, for growing up and leaving and forgetting to call. Ourselves for being less than we planned when we were young and dreamed of outer space and Olympic medals. Such sprawling deficiency, ours, theirs, ever more varieties and degrees as each new day passes, to be acknowledged, to be pardoned. And yet we do. We love and are loved anyway. Differently, though, than we might have thought. From parent to teenager, I love you is not I love the way our interactions leave me feeling useful and appreciated, and like I'm definitely in the top percentile of parents working today. It's even though I delivered you at permanent expense to my genitals, and you rolled your eyes at me when I tried to hit the dab, and you trapped me in that modern-day torture chamber of club music and olfactory assault, Abercrankie and filth. Then later that day, impatient to be taken to Bridget's house, you beeped at me from the passenger seat in the driveway, like maybe I worked for you. I love you. Or from one sibling to another, I love you is not I love the way we instantly make sense to each other and fall into plans effortlessly and always remember each other's birthdays. It's even though we hardly agree about a thing, including who should be president, how often we should call each other, or even where to get hoagies, I love you. Or from a middle-aged woman to her mother, I love you is not I love how we share clothes and taste in movies and concur on all aspects of raising a girl circa 2017. It's even though every time we talk, you tell me Joan Jennings' hearing is shot and ask me if I saw what Mark Cuban said on Shark Tank or if you should get a Roku or why your avatar on Netflix is a purple raccoon, and then we pretend you might one day come out to California again, even though it's been 5 years and we both know you're never getting on a plane again. I love you. Or to a dying parent, in this case a father. I love you is not I love your spot-on career advice or how you always give it to me straight. It's even though you said you were feeling better after I smoothed your corn silk hair and put a pill way back on your tongue and cleaned your dentures under the running water and changed your diaper. Even though I begged you not to leave, or if you had to leave, to just open your eyes one more time, and you left anyway. And I can't find you anywhere except on my answering machine where your boyish voice is asking me if we caught the last play of the Notre Dame game. I love you. The first time the words passed between two people, electrifying. 10,000 times later, cause for marvel. And the last, the dream you revisit over and over and over again.
What do you miss most about your dad?
Talking to him. Like, I miss the moment that he would pick up the phone and say, "Lovey, how are you?" Like, I hadn't talked to him, like, in 24 hours.
Right.
There's so much you want to tell. Like, there's so few people who love you that much. Like, most people are really busy with their own lives. And fair enough. And I'm busy with mine. And but, like, he just was so excited about me and about my husband and about my children. And, like, I'd just tell him anything and he'd just do a backflip over it, you know?
Yeah.
So everything that happens, I think, ugh. Like, I just got to have dinner with Katie Ledecky, the swimmer, mm-hmm. and Bryce Love, the running back for Stanford. And I thought, God, he would just die. If I called him from the way home from this, he'd be like, Lovey, are you kidding me? God, that's amazing. Tell me everything. You know, and there's nobody like that in the world for me anymore.
Edward, not so much.
No way. No way. I mean, I love him, but he's just a husband.
Are there things about grief that surprised you in going through
Yes.
it?
I was surprised by how long it is. I was surprised how unpredictable it is. Like, I can go a long time now without crying, like, you know, 3 months or something, and then the trigger will be just the most unexpected thing. Joan Didion did such a nice job with the idea of magical thinking, but there is this real wrestling with the permanence. Like, even though we know that there's no going back, it's really our first encounter with permanence. And I guess can't tell you how many times the only thought in my head was looping, was like, I know, but just one quick conversation. Like, can I just get through to him for like 1 second? Like, I know I can't have him. I know I'm not going to see him again. I know I'm never going to like hug him again. But like, I just would like 1 minute. Like, I'm doing some kind of negotiation. Like, it was truly almost maddening to me that really, 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 no matter what, because I'm an optimist, so I hardly ever think that something can't be done. I almost always think that if you just keep plugging, maybe you could get it, and you can't have this. It doesn't matter how much you want it.
Right. Let me reach out to our listeners one more time who are just joining us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking to Kelly Corrigan and about her most recent book, Tell Me More. If you have a question or comment, please feel free to call us or email us. The number to call to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. We actually have Keith on line one. Please join us, Keith.
Hello.
Hi. Good evening. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I just want to say I completely appreciate your perspective on things. I totally believe that everybody's favorite subject matter is themselves. Yeah, and your comment around, just listen. Keep listening to your kids. Keep listening. I work with at-risk youth, and one of the things is they just never feel like they're ever heard, and you just keep listening until they actually figure out what's going on for themselves just by hearing themselves out loud, and you just keep being encouraging around it, and it seems to be a perspective of yours, and I completely appreciate your angle.
Yeah.
How you treat people.
Thank you so much, Keith.
I mean, I think a cool thing is to help help them go further in their thinking about something so that they get mm-hmm. a little bit past where they usually stop in their thinking,
right.
You know, if it's a breakup or it's a frustration or it's a set of anxieties or something that they want or something they feel like they want but they don't actually want, or, you know, like to help them. That's why I think saying tell me more or go on or what else, like
right.
You could just live with those words alone. You could get through 90% of your interactions with people just saying those three things, and they would probably get further in terms of like understanding why they feel how they do about something or why they made a choice they made or what they want to do next time or...
Right, exactly. Well, I think you nail it with the word feelings. I think feelings are not necessarily an indication of the truth. It's just feelings, and feelings change. But if you just keep working at it, you'll actually get past what your feelings are telling you about you and kind of narrow down what's really kind of going on for you, and you can actually keep moving forward if you just kind of get past what's kind of happening.
Yeah, and you know what the thing I think about that is that, and I feel like this with myself a lot and with my husband, because, you know, we sometimes have to train the men in our lives, not you, Keith, but sometimes we have to train the men in our lives to not solve the problem. But what I think is that there's this like white hot emotion, and that emotion will not dissipate and allow for like cognition until somebody else feels it with you. So it's like everybody wants to feel they've been felt. And then once I'm sure that you are like feeling me, then I start to like release that and I can think again. But you can't really think clearly when you're all hot. But the only way to cool down is to like release it into the air and have somebody feel it with you.
Exactly, because nobody can actually be with you when you're really hot. It's just like, oh my God, you're just so hot. Forget it. I'm not even going to be near that.
Right.
But when you start to cool down a little bit and cultivate whatever's kind of going on and feel like you're being heard, completely agree with you.
And stifling is so dicey.
Yes.
Like stifling is where lots of bad things, that's like the beginning of a super bad road.
That leads actually to the next question I want to ask you.
Oh, good.
Thank you, Keith, for calling. I appreciate
You're
it.
You're welcome. Thanks so much. All right. I appreciate
Thank
the
you.
Call. All right. Thank you.
This all kind of keys on, it reminds me, one of the chapters of your book, when you're talking about Camp Kesem and this camp that where kids who have lost or are losing family members to cancer are able to go and to be supported and to talk. And you, I think, have done some fundraising for them and some work with them, and you got to visit them. Can you talk a little bit about that experience? And I think there was one girl in particular that you really learned something from.
So this friend of mine, Liz, who I write a lot about and Tell Me More, was at the time was terribly, terribly sick. She was at the end of 7 long years of ovarian cancer. And there was this camp, and they found me and invited me to come and sort of observe. And my dad had already died of cancer, and Liz was dying. And I was so stunned by the way this 12-year-old treated me. So she was one of those kids who has very adult features, and she looked like a petite adult woman. You know, tiny little hands, but like manicured fingernails. And she would say the most sophisticated things. And I asked her, you know, if she were considered among her friends at home to be the wise one. And she said yes. And I said, and are those relationships, you know, more superficial than the relationships that you're having at camp with all these kids who have been made wise, if you will, by their life circumstances? And she said, you know, they're not superficial, they're just limited. And then it just sort of flew out of my mouth, and I said, do you think broken people are better? And she said, I do. She said, it's a big price to pay, but I do, and I would just never want to be with a normal person. And I feel that, and I felt it when I was sick. You know, I had a really charmed life, and then I was 36 years old with 2 kids in diapers and in chemotherapy, and I was like the youngest kid in the infusion center at UCSF every time. Not that there aren't plenty of people much younger than 36 doing chemo. And I felt like, oh, now I've just been initiated. And now the people who have lived through something, it's like a dog whistle or something. Like, you could be in a party, and from that day forward, you're connecting with people in a different way. Because they trust you with their thing, whatever their thing, you know, whatever their crisis was. And it was, I remember during 2008 when people's husbands were losing their jobs and they were moving to smaller houses and, you know, really getting caught in the crosshairs of the financial crisis. And so many people would talk to me about it, even though I didn't have that specific problem. But it was like, and people who were getting divorced would come to me, come to my door and say, like, I have to talk to you. And it was like, the only reason you picked me is because you know that I, you know, I got run over by a truck too. And it doesn't matter what the tread marks were that were left behind. Like, if you've been run over by a truck, you've been run over by a truck. And but it creates this potential for intimacy and connection that I just don't know is possible, like on a sunny day when everything's going right.
Is it based in empathy, do you think? Is it because you've been through something really difficult that you are able to sit with something really hard? Or what do you think?
I think they trust you, that you're not going to be freaked out. Like a normal person might be a little more freaked out. And also, I think that crisis makes you think a lot. So you're really stewing on big, hard ideas, like what is your identity and what is, how do you feel about your mortality and how is this loss going to affect you and where are your anxieties about your health and your future or your career or your life as a single woman. And so just going up one level from that, you've thought about anxiety, you've thought about your future, and you're thinking in these new, harder terms. And so you just have more to give each other because you've just wrestled with more, you know?
So you're keying in on the most important things that
yes,
that...
and you've tried to have, you've been forced to come up with your values and to articulate them, and you've been shown in no uncertain terms the difference between what matters and what doesn't.
Right.
And you've seen it clear, like, you know, those days when the woman calls and says you have cancer, and that's a day when there's total clarity, and hopefully you can carry that forward with you. I mean, hopefully that can serve you.
If you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW in San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking to author Kelly Corrigan. Her most recent book is Tell Me More, which you brought some extra copies of.
And, I did. I have four copies for four callers.
Fantastic. So please give us a call with your question or comment. If there's a phrase that has helped you connect to people during dark times, or if humor has helped you... please give us a call or email us. The number to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. We do have a caller, Nancy from San Francisco. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. I'm so gratified and I'm so much at rest in my heart hearing these words about just tell me more. Tell me more. Tell me more. Because I've been struggling with communication, you know, and realizing I do a lot of intercultural work, and I've been trying to confront people or get people to listen to my processing of what I'm going through and what they're going through so that we can find some kind of common ground and all this stuff. And it's just been creating a lot of roadblocks because not everyone's ready for that, and it just makes them defensive. So this has been a really wonderful gift tonight to hear this idea of just saying, tell me more.
It's good.
So liberating. This is going to change my life because I'm going to go out now. I'm going to do that all the time.
That's so great. Well, one of the chapters is called I Don't Know, which is about everything from I don't know what we should do about public education in America, even though I want to, like, grab on to some headline and say, that's it. I don't know at all what we should do about Iraq or North Korea. I don't know how I feel about God. I don't know if I'm ever going to get sick again. I don't know why my friend Mary Hope was never able to get pregnant. And embracing how little it is that we could actually say with utter certainty, and what a, like, kind of cheap crutch that is. And it's sort of ugly. Like, I have totally flipped, and not just because of this president, but it's related, actually, from, like, loving a person with a lot of conviction and a lot of answers to finding them deeply suspicious. And I feel like we're so hungry for conviction, and that it's most generally taking us in a problematic direction. So I think it's fine that you don't know what to say to these people and that you just want to sit there and say, tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. Like, it will work. I believe it will work.
But Nancy, we will send you a copy of her book. I'm gonna turn you back over to my producer and give her your address, and we'll get this book to you.
Wonderful! What a gift! I didn't know I was gonna get a book. I'm so happy.
I'm signing it right now to Nancy.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you for calling, Nancy. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye bye. Bye bye. I know that you do a lot of work for a lot of great organizations, and I know that you also love to go to readings of other authors and you love live music, and I know that you put together a really special event called Notes and Words. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's the best. Please. It's the best nonprofit work I've ever done. And I worked for United Way for 10 years, my first 10 years out of college. So Notes and Words is in it'll this coming spring, so 1 year from now, will be the 10th annual. And it's writers and musicians on stage together. We alternate a reading and a musical set, and then a reading and a musical set, and then a reading and a musical set. So three and three. It's at the Fox Theater in Oakland, and all the money goes to UCSF Children's Hospital, Benioff Children's Hospital, Oakland. And so my kid, Claire, my second daughter, had meningitis as a baby. And we went there, and we really loved the experience. And then I was writing about it for Lyft, which is my second book. And I thought, oh, I should do something. I should do a reading for the hospital or some kind of fundraiser. And then we got thinking that maybe it would be cool to do it with a musician friend of ours. My husband has a great friend who's a super talented musician named Mike Errico. And so it sort of like grew from there. And last year, well, in May 12th, we just had the 9th annual. We had George Saunders, who won the Man Booker Prize, and Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters. And we raised $1.8
million.
$1.8 million.
One night.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So the goal was always, I want to raise $1 million in a night. And when I first met the people at Children's, they were like, good, nice, that sounds super. Like, you're going to read a little bit from your book and raise $1 million. And I was like, see, this is why I think I can still talk to my dad. So I was like, I know, but I think it can be done, because I had just done this thing for George and Barbara Bush, have a fundraiser once a year where they have six writers and we each read for 10 minutes. And they have writers from each, like, genre, if you will. So it was like John Meacham, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Jeff Kinney, who did Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Brad Thor, me, and a cookbook guy. And they raised $1.5 million. Now, there he was the president and the father, the parents of a president, and they probably have a lot of really fancy friends. But I left that saying, like, I think this is doable, especially if we swap out three of the writers for musicians. Then we could really jack things up. And so my friends Melissa Williams and Christina Smith do it with me, and Christina figured out how to get us into the Fox, and then Melissa figured out how to organize it in a way that wouldn't be excruciating for the hospital. And anyway, it's the best night of the year. It's total heaven. And we've had Chris Martin, we had David Diggs, we had so many great authors: Michael Chabon, Michael Lewis, Jane Smiley, Mary Roach, Anne Lamott.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's heaven.
Fantastic. If you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We are talking to author Kelly Corrigan, and she was kind enough to bring some copies of her recent book, Tell Me More, which is about the hardest but most important things people can say to one another. If you have a question or comment, please call in or email us. We have a couple copies to give away, and we have a few more minutes in the show. So I also want to hear about your podcast, Exactly. Tell us about that.
You know, over the years, I've been writing for 10 years, and I have been able to do tons of in conversations with really interesting writers. And so we started recording them a while ago, and that became this podcast called Exactly, and you can find it everywhere you can find your podcasts. And they're just these kind of open-ended, long-form conversations of, I think we did John Cleese, Margaret Atwood, which is fascinating. Nice. And I've gotten to do a couple in conversations with her, and she's every bit as whip-smart as you think she is, and very funny and sharp and challenging and delightful, and she's a total twinkle in her eye. We did her. We did B.J. Novak, who's really the force behind The Office. He did it with Greg Daniels, and he also played Ryan, and he's been in tons of movies, and he wrote a great book of short stories called Stories and More Stories. And I think that was my favorite one. So if you're only going to listen to one, listen to the Exactly BJ Novak. But yeah, it was a fascinating, that's a great like perk of being a writer, is getting to talk to other writers.
Great. All right. And we have an email from Glenn in Mill Valley who asks, how would you describe your writing process? Do you feel your work is
pitiful.
Ever done?
No.
Or that your interpretation of the material changes as you do?
Yes. I mean, I don't I don't have, my process has evolved as my children have gotten older. So with The Middle Place, I had two kids in preschool. And so everything was pinned on that. I would drop them off at 9 a.m., go to the cafe around the corner, write until noon, pick them up, and take them home. And then the next day, I would look at what I wrote the day before and try to tweak it, pick them up at noon. So I was writing in three-hour chunks every day. And it was a very effective schedule for me. It was very... and I liked being in a cafe. I like somebody bringing me coffee. It feels like I'm a little present for, you know, doing the work. And I also like that window is a nice window. 3 hours is a nice window. This was also really in 2005 and 6, so not a lot of internet, not a lot of email.
But wasn't that when you were sick? I was wondering how you wrote this book when your kids were young. You're, you know, the mother of young children. You're dealing with breast cancer. You're dealing with your father's cancer.
Breast cancer really clears your calendar. It really does. You don't do anything. There's so many things that people do every single day and week that they would not do if they were diagnosed with cancer.
Oh.
It's actually not a terrible thing to thought experiment, to look at your calendar and say, would I do any of this if I were diagnosed with cancer right now? Not that I thought I was dying, but it just was like, oh, I'm definitely not going to keep doing.
It just clarifies your priorities.
Yeah. And so I just had and people were making so much space for me. Like, you know, my mom was doing my laundry for me. We got a house cleaner. And so I actually had very little to do, and it was such a thoughtful, introspective period that I wanted to write anyway. I'm a person who writes in journals. And so I was doing it. And then when my dad got sick, I thought, oh, my God, I got to do this, because I always wanted to write. I always wanted to write a book. It was, like, always my dream. And I thought, it's stupid and it's embarrassing, and I don't want to ever admit it to anybody because it makes it seem like I think I'm so smart, which I definitely don't, because I'm definitely not. And then when he was sick, I thought, oh, I have to do this just because I have to give it to him. And self-publishing had just become a thing. So I thought, well, it doesn't even matter. I don't even have to beg anybody. I can just send it to Minnesota, and they'll send me back a book. And that's what I did. And they sent me back a book, and I gave it to my dad. But I also gave it to my sister-in-law, Edward's little sister. And she gave it to this guy, Jack Horner. And Jack Horner gave it to this woman, Andy Barbsey, at ICM. And then off it went.
And then it's on the New York Times bestseller list. That's
yeah.
Amazing. That's
yeah.
Amazing. Okay, we have Mike from San Francisco. Welcome, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I lost my father at a pretty young age to cancer, and it was actually sort of a timely interview for me because my wife is in the hospital with lupus complications. And what we're finding is that because we've sort of both been hit by the proverbial truck, like you say, we're really good at interacting and comforting each other in this. So that really resonated with me when you said that. And it also reminds me of the poem One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. And the line in that is, the art of losing isn't hard to master. And though loss and grief might not be any easier, I think we get better at dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. That's a lot of stuff to deal with. But I think that there... I was just talking to a friend of mine, Chris, whose sister's very sick, and there are privileges. There are intimacies that are available to us, and I really felt that with Liz. I felt like for whatever combination of reasons, and definitely related to the fact that I had done chemotherapy myself, and you know, I had been to a lot of doctor's appointments, and I had had just a tiny brush with what she was living. You know, I did 2 years of treatment; she did seven. That she picked me in a way. I mean, she had this great friend Jessica McCarthy who was like her lead, and I was sort of second, right behind her, and it was such a privilege to be allowed to be in the room with her. You know, I never learned more. I've never understood more. I've never felt more. Like, it was a complete realization of my humanity. Like, I was as stretched as I could be.
Thank you so much for your call, Mike. I just want to get to one more caller. Let's see. We have Alka. Welcome, Alka.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And, you know, I stumbled into this interview, and I almost feel it's a gift because I felt like I needed to hear this all day. I lost my dad to cancer in December, 7 years after I lost my mom, which was all of a sudden, and I don't know which one was, you know, where I got to say goodbye better. So, you know, that's something I'm still processing. But it was only after I lost my dad that I was able to breathe and say, oh, I was waiting all this time to tell my mom things who I knew wasn't going to come back. And now I wanted to tell her about how it was to lose my dad. And it became clear to me that I wouldn't get to do it. So this whole phenomena of knowing the permanence and not relating to it, and struggling with it, you know, so it kind of, both losses hit me at the same time. But the question, I mean, there's so many things I wanted to say to you, but the question I have was, I have a five-year-old, and after this loss, you know, I was vacillating between my real feelings and then making my parents alive for my daughter, and then noticing that it was too much for her. So if you have any ideas of how to bring this, you know, in an honest way to somebody who's five, and my husband hasn't been through this loss, so it's almost like a journey on my own a little bit with her for me.
I think there's a lot of time to play this out with her. Like, I'm still talking, you know, my dad died three years ago and three months. And I think that in some ways I'm going to be talking about it and at different levels with my daughters forever. You know, so there's things I haven't told them yet, specifics that I haven't told them that I know I will. And there are feelings that of mine that I haven't revealed to them that I expect to over time. And so I guess I would say, you know, she can just be five now, and someday she'll be 13 and leaning into you, and someday she'll be 19, and someday you'll be old, and, you know, and then there'll be these different opportunities to make use of all that grief.
Thank you so much for your call, Alka. I'm sorry we are out of time, but I'm going to turn you back over to our producer because you have a copy of Kelly's book coming to you if you'd like. You can give your address to our producer. That is City Visions for this evening. My guest is Kelly Corrigan, author of Tell Me More, Stories About the 12 Hardest Things I'm Learning to Say. Thank you so much for joining me, Kelly.
Yeah, that's great.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David Latulipe. Tonight's show is produced by yours truly, Ann Harper and Jennifer Ruick in the studio. Join us next time on City Visions when we're going to be talking about the teacher shortage in Bay Area public schools. This is Ann Harper. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.